Hello, welcome to another Pharmacy in Practice podcast. Really quite exciting this morning. We've got a good friend and colleague, a member of the English Pharmacy Board, RPS Board, Hemant Patel. Hemant is the secretary of the North East London LPC. Would you like to introduce yourself, Hemant?
Yes, Jonathan, firstly, thank you for asking me to speak on this podcast. I'm delighted to firstly say congratulations on your idea to have a podcast. Hopefully, you know, it will grow as we go along, but the idea is brilliant. I love it. Thank you for inviting me.
That's very kind of you. Thank you very much. It's completely made up as I go along, so don't be fooled. There's no skill or planning in it. Now, question one: are you in your pajamas?
Absolutely. I had a terrible night, and I got up and picked up your text message, and I'm ready to go.
Me too. Well, I'm in my pajamas as well. 10:30 on a Saturday morning, so
yeah, relaxed.
Exactly. So question one then, proper question one. Yeah. What's your vision for pharmacy?
My vision for pharmacy is that we can do everything the doctors can do apart from surgery. And that means initially taking over all the repeat prescribing for stable, and I emphasize the word stable, long-term conditions, providing care for urgent care, and playing a big role in prevention of long-term conditions. And by prevention, I just don't mean smoking cessation or chlamydia testing, all that kind of stuff. I want to be ready for the technological developments where we would be able to take a drop of blood and predict whether the person is likely to develop diabetes in 10 years' time or not, and help them map out so that they add years to life and quality to the life they enjoy. So in short, I just want to help people to enjoy a healthy and a happy life. And whatever it takes, apart from surgery, I want to do it. I'll use technology, I will upskill, and I will work with others in a team.
And so people do listen to this podcast, and you know, no one's more surprised than me, to be honest. Quite a few thousand since Christmas, to be honest.
Yes.
And I rarely kind of use my platform to shift the conversation, but I'm going to do that now, actually. Yeah. I want to shift the conversation away from individual representative bodies, because it's very tempting to go down that route.
Yes.
And I just want to make it clear that I want the conversation to be about pharmacists and pharmacy and pharmacy technicians, perhaps, and what we can achieve together. I don't want it to be about a particular body. And I'm going to get the negative out of the way first.
Yes.
One thing that made me quite sad, and it's an indictment of where we are as a profession, in my humble opinion, is the whole Brexit thing. And one yes. thing specifically, one innovation that should have happened years ago in community pharmacy was pharmacists being able to swap stock. Now, my reading of this situation is completely sad, that it takes a complete constitutional crisis for us to consider developing pharmacy practice in community and be realistic yes. about it. What does that say about our profession?
It says that our scanning of the horizon is extremely poor. We do not. We look for a word starting with a P and only focus on that. The technology changes, the political situation changes, the economics changes, and we see that as a distant thing rather than part of the factors that actually contribute to our existence. I would like to see a policy scanning unit somewhere, which, if you like, is a watchman looking over the horizon and saying, okay, guys, these are the things which are going to happen, and do something about it. And I'm a huge fan of some work being taken, undertaken by Bath University, where a young pharmacist is developing a PhD on policies. So people get confused between policies and politics. I'm not talking about politics. I'm talking about policies which then lead to good strategies, which then lead to good operations in our pharmacies and elsewhere. So I think if I wanted one gift to be given to my profession, it is a policy scanning unit which is producing timely advice to the leaders and to others. We used to have one at RPS, SGB, but it's gone now. And I think the price we are paying, the uncertainty, I think what policy units would do is actually reduce the uncertainty, because we will be expecting changes. And if we are expecting changes, we will be better placed to act, think about what we can do. I think we are constantly being taken by surprise.
Mm-hmm. I agree.
Got to change.
I agree, yeah. Actually, and that's why I asked the question. I think I'm loath to be an advocate for talking shops, but I do think there's a place in pharmacy for a think tank, not for profit, completely independent. A think tank. I mean, Pharmacy Voice was the closest thing we had recently, headed up by Rob Darricott, and unfortunately that disappeared because, you know, these things cost money, obviously.
Yeah.
But I do think I agree with you. There seems to be an acute lack of vision. I'm going to stay on this example.
Sure.
Because I think it's an interesting case study to articulate or explore where pharmacy's at. So we've got the point that the constitutional crisis has nudged us towards maybe changing our practice. Do you think, I mean, the precedent for this, or the background to this next question, is the fact that I think whilst pharmacists are completely capable of doing stock swap stuff, I mean, what on earth is the risk of swapping Fusidin ointment for Fusidin cream, for goodness sake? But there are potential additional medical legal risks. Do you think pharmacists should be paid more to take on those risks?
No one would say no to more money. But I think you've got to have a yardstick first before we talk about more money.
Yeah.
And our scorecard is changing, and we are still thinking. So I'll give you a simple example. If I ask a pharmacist that there's a bottle of medicine for £1, how much would you sell it over the counter? They would add 50% markup and add VAT on it and sell it. If I then say to them, okay, there is a 15-minute a session required with a patient, how much do you want to be paid for it? They'll be lost. They might probably look at locum costs or plus a little bit more. We have got no idea about value-added pricing. And so I think we are very good in terms of our work. We are very good in terms of productivity. But things which enable us to value our work is very poorly defined. So it's very easy to price a bottle of medicine. It is not that easy to price the time taken to help a patient achieve a good outcome. And I think there's work needed by the professional bodies, because if we are going to get a service-based contract, what are we going to price our services? What is the baseline? What is the minimum recovery time that we need to do in order to have a good income? And, you know, it's a complex thing. It depends on volume. It depends on impact that we are going to have. And also the money the government or the commissioner has got. So I think we really need to start thinking very hard about how we price our services in a competitive world where... and also, I think there is economies of scale. And I think government is looking at that because I think very soon there'll be refocus on control of entry, supervision, and role of a pharmacist in an integrated team. Government has signaled in England that they will be negotiating a new contract. But before new contract, I assume there's going to be a whole lot of questions to say, okay, before we pay you, are you ready for the change? I.e. a smaller network where more than one pharmacist is working, because they're not going to pay us for the same amount of... they're not going to continue to pay us for just doing dispensing. There's a huge need for service-led contract.
I like that answer, Hemant. I must admit, I really agree with you. I think we've, you know, at the risk of being completely blunt on this podcast, yeah. I think pharmacy, PLC, we've been selling ourselves cheap for years, you know?
Yes.
I think that, and I take it back to that stock swap idea.
Yeah.
You know, to safely do that, you need initial training of the pharmacist. You need arguably supervision of the pharmacist within practice. You need competence-based sign-off for the practice. There may be certain drugs where you might need, if you're swapping, they will have potential significant impact on the stability of that patient's health. And there needs to be insight into that. And to gain insight, you need, you know, a period of time to build competence, and also get sign-off, I would say, from a medical practitioner. Now, that's leading towards being an independent prescriber. And the trouble with independent prescribing is that it's wonderful to train loads of APs. It's great. But I go back to this figure that the GPHC, I think it was back in 2015, only something like 7% of IPs newly qualified write a prescription within the first year. That there is the problem. And that again, relates back to my stock swap idea or concept, because there is a return of investment for the government or other stakeholders to implement such a scheme. But we've got to lay it out. We've got to write it down. How much does it actually cost to do it safely? And what's the return? Where are the benefits? Well, probably, you know, receptionist cost at the GP practice, saved appointments, all this stuff. There's a tangible projection of a return there. Why are we not making that? And whose job is that to do that?
I think the whole process needs to be laid out. So in Northeast London, and I think some people think we have declared UDI unilateral, you know, independence, and it may be true, may not be true, but we have decided we are going to take charge of the situation. So we have created a vision for community pharmacy, which we call High Street Clinic. We are deliberately not calling it community pharmacy because there is baggage with a label. We've called it High Street Clinic, where we want to do all kinds of things. Now, the critical thing is, why are community pharmacists called community pharmacists? Is it because they are located in community, or is it because we have relationships with communities? I think both are important. The key thing is that we have not focused on relationships with communities. If we develop, we have got relationships. However, we have not played to our strengths. Their needs are defined by a doctor. Their needs are defined by surveys. Community pharmacy plays no role in defining a patient need. If you have got no role in defining patient need, and then there is someone ahead of you who defines need, all the money will go towards them, because they will define it and they'll produce a solution before we can. So we really need to establish ourselves, or rather re-establish ourselves with a different purpose. We should become community orientated, understand the process by which needs are defined, and then be ready to input that into the equation. Because in England, the NHS is going to be broken down into 44 local NHS services, comparable to Scotland, Wales, and Northern Ireland. Now, the rules are different. There's going to be a lot of local decision making. And I think instead of just going on about the pharmacy needs assessment, we should go back to the basic and say, what are the needs of the communities? What role can we play in community development? What role can we play in public health? What role can we play in primary care? What role can we play to help individuals assess their needs? I mean, there isn't a single tool available to community pharmacists to define pharmaceutical needs, however narrow that definition of pharmaceutical needs is. I find that absolutely crazy. Going on about being experts in medicines, it means nothing, because you have not defined anything which enables community pharmacists to define new needs. So I think before, we all know the process by which money is allocated. Define a need, prioritize those identified needs, attach money to it, and then go for operation plans. What we want is more money without actually understanding how the healthcare system defines need and allocates money. Going to the MPs and getting them on board is a waste of time. The civil servants and the commissioner that lead the NHS are really evidence-based. And they also have opinions. And a lot of the work is based on opinions, which has been shaped by, cleverly, I would say, by the GPs. We really need to understand this process of how need is identified and money is allocated to it. So I think just as there is a lack of policy and development at the top, at the bottom in the grassroots level, there is an deep, need for understanding how the local priorities are established, because that's where the money is going to be.
Yeah, again, really, really enjoyed that answer. I mean, that's. It's very, very astute. It's funny you should mention the term prioritization. I did a podcast with Kathy Geeson recently, and she's a pharmacist who works in hospital, but she developed a patient level tool to prioritize medicines optimization needs. Now, the study that she did deployed that tool in hospital pharmacy, but she is might be worth a conversation, because she's looking to take that tool elsewhere. And that leads me on to the strategic point around what you're saying. I mean, you know, let's be honest, at the risk of being cynical, any customer will buy a product usually because they think, A, it benefits them.
Yes.
Flashy car, status, you know, example, or because they're scared. So other end of the spectrum, they'll buy insurance because they're scared of that one-off. Now, I think my view is that, and I agree with you, that it could be done through prioritization of pharmaceutical needs and more targeted approach. Pharmacy PLC needs to create that demand. They need to help the people who have the money understand that there is actually a need, and again, demonstrate the return of investment, and on we go.
Yeah. I mean, it requires an organization. We have got a lot of resource in pharmacy, not as much as medics, but we do have a lot of resource. But it is competitive, and often things get dropped down. So, for example, I would say, where is the pharmacist's response to home care, which is going to grow day by day? What are we doing about supporting people to become more mobile and lead an active life in wheelchairs, commodes, all that kind of stuff? the people need daily living aids. There's a population which is aging, and like me, they need all kinds of stuff, walking stick, all that kind of stuff. Where is it? What is the strategy? There's going to be a lot of emphasis on OTC because medicines are going to be deregulated and going there. We then hand it over to the counter assistants and then forget about it. There's a whole big market around nutraceuticals. And as the government begins to bite into prevention agenda, focus is going to move away from medicines towards good nutrition. I'm not saying we open up a healthier version of McDonald's, but I think we really need to understand a few things about nutrition, and we can reverse diabetes. Diabetes consumes 25% of the NHS resource. And if we start talking about reversing diabetes and the path we can carve out for our population, government will be interested. We talk about prevention. But there's going to be powerful technologies, biomarkers, which I talked about. Pharmacogenomics is on the horizon, and we are not ready for it. There's going to be drones which will be delivering medicines very soon. And it will, we might resist it for a little while, but the dam will burst at some point, and at that time, we will be poorly prepared. Automation in pharmacy to improve efficiency. Now, we can argue, it is not that very effective, it's very costly, all that kind of stuff. But are we actually saying automation is not going to happen in pharmacy? It's damn crazy. It just makes me angry. I think what we should be saying to the government is, okay, you want automation, we'll help you achieve that. Let's talk about what are the options in order to get that. And it means working differently with technicians. It means us, okay, you want automation, we will give you automation. In return, what are we going to get? That's the kind of dialogue we really need to have. And then have the money to upskill to a new job that is enjoyable and worthwhile. There's going to be, we have got GPs coming on my phone and giving me advice 24 hours a day. Ask your pharmacist, is 9 to 5 or 9 to 7 in some areas. So what are we going to do about a 24-hour challenge, which is going to be posed by technology as well as the politicians? What about group sessions where we can work with groups of people to help them improve their health? Population health is coming. It is not a myth. We do not even know the difference between population health and public health, and how we can be big players in supporting patients to manage their own care. Health coaching is a growing field of area. We are sitting there waiting, allow others, including physicians' assistants, to occupy that space. So whilst we are protecting old space, we are allowing people to move into new space, and they will create their own identity, their own relationships. And all this can happen in a community pharmacy. Mm-hmm. But we need a powerful vision. We need to inspire people. And yes, change produces fear. Mm-hmm. And it is a risky business when you're trying to reposition yourself. So care needs to be taken that you don't burn bridges. But at the same time, I think we need to work very hard to say and give a very clear signal to the government, we are ready for change. In return, we will want support to make that change sustainable for us as well as for you. I think that's the kind of dialogue we need to move towards. All this going to courts and petitions and things like that hasn't taken us anywhere. In fact, I think we are 10 years behind GPs, if not more. That gap will get bigger because of the time we have wasted at leadership level and at grassroots level. And I think in Northeast London, what we are trying to do is to say, come on, guys, if things were in our control, what would we want and what can we do? Let's take that to the commissioners. And I have to say to you, I'm delighted with the response from the pharmacists in Northeast London. I'm delighted with the commissioners. We now have a place everywhere a GP sit. We now have a place where everywhere the provider companies sit. And the dialogue has started around how we can deliver the high street clinic model that has been developed locally. And I am delighted that the response from people to gaining new skills is powerful. And last Thursday, we had 120 people who says, right, we are ready to embark on a journey to get postgraduate qualifications. And we are working with one or two universities to try and deliver that local training, which will put people on a pathway for a new career as clinicians. Everybody's clinicians, I agree, but some clinicians are better than others. And what I want to make sure is locally, our clinicians are better than they used to be and are capable of working in a team, either virtually or in a face-to-face situation.
I love your enthusiasm, Hilbert. It's just, yeah, it's completely infectious, your passion in that. Yeah, I agree with you on the, I'd like to see more of a meritocracy in pharmacy, to be honest, especially community pharmacy. I think, you know, hospital pharmacy have been better at that, you know, demonstrating competence and sort of differentiating practice and stuff like that. I quite enjoy hearing how you're starting to make the career path in community in your local area have a bit more depth. So, you know, advanced practice, perhaps, you know, prescriber, non-prescriber. So that creates a much more interesting career experience, doesn't it?
Yes, absolutely. On day one, we will not have pharmacists taking over prescribing and repeat prescribing. But we need to have a 3 to 4 year pathway where, let's say, 55-year-old Mr. Patel, who has never touched a BNF since leaving school or pharmacy, can be supported to become clinically competent and confident and has got the credibility within his peer group as well as with GPs, that he knows what he's doing. Similarly, we want our 25-year-olds to also have a place for it. So working together, we need to make sure that people at different stages of their career are able to transit to a more secure future by learning new skills. And I think if that is going to change, because every 10 years, the knowledge that we have becomes outdated. And therefore, new learning has to go on a regular basis. That is the way the world is shaping. And we need to take advantage of that instead of being afraid of it.
Absolutely. I'm loving hearing about this project in Northeast Scotland, or Northeast Scotland, Freudian slip. About obviously, pharmacy's better in Scotland, I would say that, wouldn't I?
And I would agree with you. When I was president, I said, if you want a secure future, go and work in Scotland. At that time, Bill Scott was your chief pharmacist. And I think he had a vision for community pharmacy. He had passion for his profession. And he was willing to do things with your leaders to make things happen. And I think we can learn a thing or two from Scotland. I'm never proud to steal your ideas or anyone else's ideas for that matter. And I think in some ways, Bernadette Brown, who is working very hard to convince people that in her hometown, she's a queen, and I salute her.
Mm-hmm. Tell me about the one thing I was interested to read in the press recently, written by you or you were reported on, was the access to the records. So I've worked in community pharmacy for, I don't know, 8 years or something, and I've been in GP practice now for a couple of years, and one of the big differences was getting access to records. Now, my concern, again, typical pharmacist, I apologize for going to the negative. I don't mean to.
I know where you're going. Go on.
You can talk me out of it. But the trouble with patient records is that you can't unsee stuff. So what I mean by that is, if you know, once you have access to everything, the medical legal ramifications ramp up completely. And I've said this before. I had a conversation with someone recently about the minor ailments service, and I don't think it was in Scotland, actually. It was down south. But anyway, basically, this pharmacist was arguing that the minor ailments service was quite safe. And of course, arguably it is, because it's more or less just the WHAM questions that we're doing. We're not doing, you know, we're not taking a proper history. We're not really following that history up with clinical assessment, blood pressure, respiratory rate, pulse rate, all that kind of stuff, to form a picture of the patient. So we're kind of, I don't mean to sound unkind, but with these minor ailment schemes, they are designed for self-limiting disorders, but we're kind of dancing around the problem, I think, and not really engaging. Now, your scheme in Northeast London, I suspect, is different, and you are engaging. So tell us a bit about how did you get access? How does that work? Who granted the access? Yes. Just really interested to know about the whole thing, to be honest.
Yeah, I think sometimes a bit of luck plays part in things. So where you are located makes a difference. In East London, there were visionary doctors, and we have got schools of medicine here. So 20 years ago, they embarked on a project to share information, and they've created something called East London Patient Record. That is designed to link up GP surgeries and all the hospitals. And I think it at the present time involves 4 CCGs, 5 acute hospitals, a mental health trust, and probably around, I would say, 220 GP practices, and covering 1.5 million people. There are leading edge thinkers there. And we talked about community pharmacy playing a role in supporting patients to stay out of hospital. And once they are discharged, stay in the community. So they were quite interested by that. So what is called EPR, LR, access, was granted to us last Thursday. And it means some developmental work will need to take place. But when we are talking about a government making a decision that we are going to be commissioning population health through population health management tools, sharing of data is absolutely critical. So at the present time, when a pharmacist makes an intervention, nobody in the health system knows about that. But what if the intervention that we made is seen by a consultant, is seen by a doctor, is seen by a commissioner, so that they can see the value I'm adding to the system, I can be paid on time. So they saw the benefits of working with us. And it took a long time, probably more than 18 months, I would say. But the benefit was seen by them of community pharmacists taking over some of the work. Why haven't we got access to blood tests? Why haven't we got access? So summary care record provides a little bit of information about the patient. But what if the pharmacist was given the whole biological data, whole social care data, whole psychological data, And we are then able to do a whole person care. We keep talking about person-centered care. We used to talk about patient-centered care, which is now an outdated concept. We talk about person-centered care so that we can provide preventative services. How can we talk about preventative services without actually knowing the whole history about how Hemant Patel became obese? I think just giving them pills and getting them to do exercise and all that isn't going to change the world. We need to actually understand the environment in which that individual is operating so that we can then suggest modifications to the lifestyle, which are personalized, or go and have a healthy diet. What does it mean? A healthy diet means different things to different people, largely dependent on what their mothers told them or what their wives cook for them. I'm a big sexist here, but I know men cook as well. But the point I'm trying to make is that the more data we have about an individual, the more we can support them. But going forward, if we are going to be involved in improving patient outcomes, and coming back to diabetes, a subject which I'm interested in, I want to try and help the NHS reverse diabetes so that 25% of their costs are reduced. Now, to do that, I need to understand who else in the system is doing anything for the patient. I want my interventions not to be duplicated and wasting resource, nor do I want things missed out. So I think the data-driven NHS is here. It is going to become more important, and we should be teaching undergraduates about managing data. Postgraduate, we should be helping people to understand all the digital tools and the data management tools that come, because we could be managing people, let's say 100 people in a pharmacy who have got diabetes. We can monitor how their health is changing and then call out somebody. Let's say, oh, in number 45, come in, please. I want to have a word with you. If you carry on the way you have been doing in the last 2 years, then the likelihood is that you will develop this, 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 and this. Let's have a discussion about how we can avoid that. So there's going to be emphasis not only on population health, but proactive interventions using new technology, and it is going to be data and person specific. That's the world we should be aiming for.
That's really interesting. The only I don't know if we disagree, maybe slightly. The only thing I have a certain reticence with data, and it's around I think the general public's fatigue with the notion of surveillance capitalism. I think we've peaked in terms of, or maybe peaking in terms of what the government, or sorry, what the public are willing to give to private companies in terms of data. It is a transaction. I could see a time where companies will actually have to pay for data, and they are already doing that within the market. But I could see a time when an individual's sort of patient data, there's already a premium on it, but I believe we're not paying for it at the moment, but that could happen. I guess where we diverge slightly, I'd really like to see these novel data apps or whatever the interface is used to move away from the paternal model. So
absolutely.
I'd like it to happen. I hope it does. I'd like the penny to drop with the patient that, you know, if they're using more than 3 salbutamols a week, then maybe their asthma isn't controlled as well as it could be, you know?
Yeah. So let me give you an example. I'll give you one acute one, one long-term condition, starting with diabetes. Imagine your blood sugar levels, instead of being measured once a day, are being measured continuously over 24 hours, 365 days a year, right? There's already a device prescribable on the NHS. It's Freestyle Libre made by Abbott. And my reading was 58 millimoles, taking 3 metformin, 850 milligrams a day, okay? that told me every time I ate, when my sugar level spiked. And what I can learn from that is how long the sugar level, how high the sugar level is going to spike, how long it is going to take. And at some stage, it's educating me about my behavior linked to the sugar level. Now, I can start to make adjustments. My reading just now is around 43, which makes me pre-diabetic. Now, this is helping me to avoid retinopathy, amputations, all the things which pharmacists know about. And being able to intervene like that, which is evidence-based, and we can devise ways in which people, if people see the benefit of sharing data, they will. Also, this personalization agenda is great. With that device, not only I know what my sugar level is at lunchtime, but I can enable my wife to know it so that in the evening she says, Herman, no chapatis or rice or potatoes for you. You've been naughty boy, right?
So pester power.
So, yeah, and I can share the same data with the GPs and rest of the health system so that they can have personal information about an individual, but also start to develop a population picture in the area of what is happening to their diabetics. How many are actually likely to need help? So the whole agenda about population health and data sharing is very exciting. And I want the profession of pharmacy to be ready to grab that time-limited opportunity. And I'll be, you know, working very hard to ensure that we play an active role in the digital world where things that we haven't thought about are possible. I am speaking about technology at the PDA conference next weekend, and I'll be talking about how a digital world can change practice of pharmacy, and there are opportunities. So at the present time, many pharmacies have got loads of perfume sitting on the glass cabinets. Why don't we put devices there and educate the people to learn about how they can manage their own health? And I think that's an area which is, crying out for help. We will complain when others take over that area. But at the present time, we are not organized enough to say, yeah, I want to be part of a local solution. So how many pharmacies actually sell a blood pressure monitor? You know, if you can't sell a blood pressure monitor, what are you doing on the high street? And what are you doing for the community? Because the money for dispensing, whether we like it or not, is going to go down. If we want to create new streams of income, we need to look at private income, we need to look at NHS income. But that will also attract a lot of competitors, pharmacies and non-pharmacies, all internet and land-based. So we really need to start thinking about adding value to the communities.
I'm almost finished, Herman. Thank you so much for your time. I still practice 2 days a week. I work in general practice now, and I do various clinics and so on and so forth. Use my prescribing, look at the records and stuff like that. I'm intrigued by this project or projects like yours where access to the records happen. And the reason I'm intrigued is because I reckon I understand what makes pharmacists nervous, because I get nervous.
Yeah.
And the thing about the access to the records, it's a funny one. It's an absolute no-brainer, but it's not without some risk. So I think access to the records is excellent for patients, because there's little doubt in my mind that when pharmacists see all the information, they'll make ever more potent interventions, save time. There's a multitude of benefits, especially if you can see the record in community pharmacy. However, like I said previously, there is a risk a medical legal risk to the pharmacist saying that. So my question is the promise of a more interesting, fulfilling, diverse career enough for community pharmacists to take that risk?
Well, I think this is about old dogs and new tricks. And when you move to new territory, there are new risks. We managed old risks before, and people trusted us to support the communities. Going forward, we will identify new risks and we'll find new ways to minimize that risk. If you want to get to the other side of the river, there is a chance that you'll be swept away. But if you time it, the risk reduces. And so I give that analogy just to confirm that everything we will do new will carry risks. Some risks would be new, some would be old. It is just a question of how we negotiate and develop tools to support us to manage our risks. And I think a lot of the time it's like driving. When you drive initially, you are driving at 10, 15 miles an hour and then building up speed. If you try and go at 90 miles an hour when you've just had one lesson, you're going to do something wrong. I agree with that. And I can understand the anxiety about taking on a new role. However, I can now drive a car. I can go abroad and drive car on the wrong side of the road, if you see what I mean. And I can come back and start driving on the right side. We are hugely adaptive animals. And I think I would rather take a risk, negotiate it, and move forward rather than be paralyzed in one position and not take the opportunities of greener grass on the other side of the river.
Definitely, and I totally I agree with that actually. And I must declare I come at this question possibly with some degree of credibility. I say that cautiously because I've taken risks in prescribing in community pharmacy. I now take risks and manage those risks in GP practice. So I come at it understanding what it's like to go there. My penultimate question is, you use the analogy of driving and learning to drive and stuff. Do you think the leaders in our profession are adequately prepared or have required understanding to be the driving instructors?
Most definitely not. And I'll tell you why. I come back to the point we made initially. Understanding of the wider perspectives and developments, technology, economics, politics, is very poor in the profession from top to bottom. There are very few people in the profession who are informed about the whole of the primary care rather than. So, when talking about primary care networks in England, people say, what about us? What about us? And I asked them, if you were given a seat on the primary care network board, what would you be talking about? Or about pharmacy? Well, bloody hell, they don't want to know anything about pharmacy. What they want to know is how do you improve the health of the local population and who are the key players that need to be engaged in order to improve health of the local populations. So I think our education system has made us very narrowly focused on medicines. The world is not about medicines. It is about how we change people's health in order to give us happiness. And I think there's a need for a much wider curriculum, undergraduate and postgraduate. Our leaders really need help instead of just criticism. It is quite right to criticize the leaders, but we must also give them resources so that they can then help us better. And I think we really need to understand the government agenda. around digital world, about changing the landscape in terms of number of places from where healthcare can be, the standards of premises that need to change. I predict one thing. There were 8,500 GP surgeries in England. By 2022-23, my guess is that there will possibly be around 6,000, something like that, or less. Now, that will have an impact on community pharmacy. By having a focus just on pharmacy and not actually understanding the whole of the primary care network, we are doing disservice to the populations that we serve and the pharmacists that we represent. So there's urgent action needed so that the agendas presented to the national leaders who are elected by their peers actually delivers meaningful and timely projects to help the local pharmacists achieve their dream of being integrated into primary care.
Brilliant. Final question. Final question.
Right.
And it's a bit of a self-indulgent one, Hemant, so do forgive me. So I've been qualified 10 years. I'm a prescriber. I've worked in community and GP. I own a pharmacy publication now. You're on my brand new podcast, which is very exciting. Knowing what you know about me, what would your advice to me be?
My advice to you is your curiosity and agility is incredible strength. And I will end, if you want, with a quote from Thomas Jefferson, a president from the US. If you want what you have never had, you must be prepared to do what you never had done. And I think, I want things which I've never done before. You want things which I've never done before. In order to get that, we must be prepared to do what we have never done before. And in the digital world, we really need to start taking calculated risks and not try and slow down at a pace which is comfortable to us, but which is comfortable to the society.
I will take your advice, Hemant. It's really, honestly, it's been a pleasure. I hope it comes across in the podcast. You enthused me, and I suspect we don't agree on everything, but hey ho, that's what makes the world go round, and that's absolutely brilliant. But what you do, what comes across is your passion for the profession. I mean, you've been qualified just a few years now, if I dare to say that.
Yeah, 78.
Yeah, you're in your mid 30s now. So, it's been a real pleasure speaking to you. And I hope people enjoy it. I hope we can do this again. It's been a real honour to have you on, actually. And enjoy the rest of your weekend. You can get dressed and get out of your pajamas now.
Well, thank you so much. I've enjoyed speaking to you as always. We have spoken on the phone in the past, and I really want our profession to reposition and close the gap between us and the GPs. And I think it's doable. But again, we have to do things differently. Thank you very much for the privilege of coming onto your podcast.
The privilege is mine. I'll speak to you soon, Hemant. Take care. Okay.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.